I'm going to start off and say I'm actually a bit of a bold boy because the title that I'm going to be talking about today and what's in your book is a little bit different. I'll be talking about the storages and the fluxes in historically isolated wetlands and their surrounding improved pasture uplands. You might have heard Dan mention earlier that Lake Okeechobee is an impaired water body, and with that impairment it's assigned a total maximum daily load, and therefore there's a lot of effort with state research dollars, state agency input, of various practices being evaluated within the watershed to try and meet that target by 2015. And when I saw this map originally, I kind of got surprised. I thought it was something you'd see in the news, like an arms race going on somewhere, and that there's war on water within the watershed. So most of the effort is being concentrated within these four priority basins. And some of the programs that are being undertaken here include phosphorus control programs, mitigation measures like restoration of historically isolated wetlands, but also cost-share programs as well, such as public-private partnerships, and also regional approaches utilising stormwater treatment areas that Jim was talking about previous. What I'm going to be talking about is historically isolated wetlands, and within the four priority basins that these wetlands are located, there's about 12,000 hectares of isolated wetlands. Of those, Dan mentioned that a lot of them are ditched and drained, and that is true. About 50% of those are ditched and drained. And this represents an opportunity for restoring those sites. So can we block the drains? Can we actively manage the water within these wetlands for the purposes of storing water and storing phosphorus in the landscape prior to that phosphorus being discharged to the impaired water body, i.e. Lake Okeechobee. So in schema, if we think of things, let me get my mouse activated here. If we have time on the x-axis and our storage on the y-axis, and we have a before and after restoration scenario. Let's say we monitor two sites. We're looking at a site that will ultimately undergo restoration and a site that will not undergo restoration. So we have a restored and unrestored. At some point, we will have restoration, but prior to that, we're tracking those systems through time. After the restoration, the unrestored site simply goes about what it was doing previous, whereas the restored site may undergo a change or a different trajectory, and the difference between the two being that effect of restoration. So the objectives of this talk that I'm going to be talking about, and some of this research has been published earlier this year in Ecological Engineering, the other part of it has not, but some of it I'll be talking about measuring the pea storages in ecosystem components and simply looking at where the pea is being stored in the wetland ecosystem and what are the proportions associated with the different components. And also quantify a pea storage gradient. So is there a pea storage gradient with landscape position? Are the wetlands storing more phosphorus relative to the uplands? Are they storing the same? And then thirdly, looking at the potential effect restoration might have, and take note of the potential effect. In terms of short-term fluctuations, we're going to look at the phosphorus flux from wetland soils and upland soils. So this is the flux of phosphorus going from soil to overlying water. And can we determine any relationships between soil characteristics and that flux from these soils? And I would call this short-term fluctuations relative to long-term storages. So the components that we focused on within the system, there was above ground biomass, which was the emergent macrophytic vegetation within the wetland. That vegetation with time dies, decays, and is laid down on the soil substrates, and we call litter. We sampled the soil down to 10 centimeters. And we also sampled the below ground biomass, the below ground roots of the emergent macrophytic vegetation. So our three strata were, we had a surrounding upland which was dominated by bahia grass. We had a central portion of the wetland which was a deep marsh area dominated by open water when it was flooded and emergent macrophytic vegetation. We had this transitional area between the upland and the wetland that we also used as an additional strata. We randomly located quadrats within these different strata. We harvested the above ground biomass, we sampled litter. We also sampled the below ground biomass, the below ground roots, down to about 15 centimetres, and we sampled the surface soils down to a depth of 10 centimetres. focusing a little bit more on the flux component of the study. We set up three transects within the wetland and 4 sampling locations along each transect. For this part of the study, we divided it up into 4 regions, and we used the wetland vegetation as a delineator of this. Okay, here we go. So we collected a core in the deep marsh area, we collected a core in the shallow marsh, which was characterized by the inside ring of the Juncus effusus. Juncus effusus was a common plant species within this transitional area. We sampled or took an intact core in the wet marsh, which was further outside that Juncus ring, and then we took an intact soil core in the pasture upland, which was dominated by bahia grass. So using some of the data that Dan and Jim generated, we determined a relative hydroperiod associated with our sample locations. And if we take a look at our graph here, on the x-axis we have deep marsh, shallow marsh and upland, and we have 4 sites. These 2 sites at Biddy Ranch, which is denoted by the B, and then these 2 sites east and west at Larsen-Dixie Ranch, LE for Larsen East and LW for Larsen West. And funny enough, we find that deep marsh areas are wetter than shallow marsh, and shallow marsh are wetter than upland. But we put a number on that, and that the hydroperiod for the deep marsh areas was about 275 days down to 125 days, depending on site. Shallow marsh hydroperiods were maybe half that, and upland sites were wet for maybe less than 20 days. Looking at the phosphorus storage, and let's focus on this figure here, the 4th figure, soil 0 to 10 centimeters, and 4 sites on the x-axis. On the y-axis we're looking at phosphorus storage grams per unit area. So it's going from 0 to 20 grams of P per square meter. P storage ranges from maybe 12 to 17 grams of P per square meter. In terms of this gradient with landscape position, we see that at least in Larsen, the P storage within these deep marsh areas seems to be more relative to the surrounding areas, i.e. the shallow marsh areas and the pasture uplands. Soils incidentally stored most of the P, about 80% relative to the other ecosystem components, taking into account below ground biomass, above ground biomass and litter. And if you take a look at the scales, we can see below ground biomass ranges from 0 to 2 grams of P per square meter, and above ground biomass ranges from 0 to 1. The landscape position and the gradient of P storage was particularly illustrative in these components, where we see this gradient with deep marsh areas storing more P in the below ground biomass relative to shallow marsh relative to upland. Okay. And we see a similar pattern in above ground. Going back to the soil, we don't see that gradient as much. Soil characteristics. Within the wetland area, we measured the organic matter content of the soils and we regressed that against total phosphorus. We found at least within the wetland, the P content is controlled by organic matter within the soil. That relationship is not necessarily true when one migrates out to the upland, and that relationship breaks down somewhat. And so other soil characteristics are responsible for storing phosphorus within the upland, presumably the mineralogical components of the soil. So if we think of a causative link between the vegetation and the soil, and the importance of accumulating organic matter within the soil, we have our vegetation. That vegetation dies, lays down that decayed material, that litter supplies the organic matter to the soil, and that organic matter within the soil is important for long-term P storage. Focusing on the actual effect of restoration and the absence of restoration, we're going to talk about the potential effect. Because in actual fact, at our sites, we're dry for about a year and a half. So there was no water. We couldn't determine the effect of restoration. And so in that scenario, and this is a bit of a joke, so I hope you get it, we decided to apply a different method. And the method that we wanted to do was the supply, sit, and wait method. So if the water wasn't going to come to the wetland, we were going to bring the water to the wetland. But in actual fact, this is another phosphorus flux study where we were supplying water at a set rate, and one of Jim's students was undertaking that study. Going back to the different ecosystem components, the soils, the biomass, and the litter, if we total those up and we look at the difference between wetland and upland, we see a difference in total storage. We know the area of the different wetlands, and let's say we increase the wetland area by maybe 20%. What kind of increased storage would one gain? And it was variable depending on site. So at this particular site, Larsen West, we achieved no additional storage, whereas in the Beattie North, we achieved an increase of pea storage of 13 kilograms of pea per hectare. So site, variable, and in some instances, no additional pea storage. Going now to the short-term fluctuations, the phosphorus flux from soils, I'm going to show you two graphs for the sake of brevity. We collected the cores along those transects, we brought those cores back to the laboratory, we flooded them with 20 centimeter water depth of water, and we looked at the flux of phosphorus over a 7-day period. We found that in these Beattie North soils, there was no flux at this initial phosphorus concentration of 0.16 milligrams of P per liter. Things were in somewhat equilibrium. Release retention varied between 1.5 retention to 1 milligram of P per square meter per day. Whereas in the Larsen West, and we saw that this achieved no additional P storage, the flux was much greater, ranging from 3 to 18 milligrams of P per square meter per day. And landscape position, we were getting variable responses in actual fact, and you know, our deep marsh areas and our pasture upland were fluxing similar amounts. So it seemed not so much related to soil characteristics, but something else was controlling the flux. Looking at the soil characteristics of these upland and wetland areas, and navigating through this table, I only want to indicate to you the rough trend. Wetland soils, the lower pH, higher water content and higher organic matter than upland areas. Our Larsen East and Larsen West, in terms of total nutrients, nitrogen, carbon and phosphorus, tended to have larger amounts relative to our Beattie sites, but this wasn't significant. And also want to talk about this grams per square meter. When you're comparing across landscape position, it's important that you compare similarly across the landscape, because depending on whether it's collected from a wetland or an upland, the bulk density is going to change. So one needs to take into account when you're comparing across landscape position, the bulk density along with the concentration of nutrient and the soil sampling depth. So you're comparing like with like, because if we only compared concentrations, we'd only be looking at concentration relative to a normalized term such as grams per square meter. So in terms of navigating through this table, we looked at correlations between the phosphorus flux and soil characteristics across landscape position. Our landscape position were our deep marsh, our shallow marsh, wet meadow and pasture upland. And I'm going to just focus on water content for a moment and use water content as a proxy for hydro period, because our initial hypothesis was everything was related to hydro period, but that wasn't necessarily the case. So let's say you collected a soil in a deep marsh area and you had high water content. You didn't necessarily get a high P flux, such that there was no relationship. If you collected soils from the shallow marsh and the wet meadow, there seemed to be somewhat of an inverse relationship, but this was variable and not significant, such that the drier the soil, the higher the flux, but it wasn't significant. The only significant result was if you collected soils from the upland area. These soils had low water content. These soils tended to flux the greatest amounts of phosphorus. And this has implications for management, and we'll talk about that in the conclusions. Funny enough, taking into account all the other soil characteristics and looking at phosphorus flux and seeing whether there was any correlations, we found few relationships. So in conclusion, and as a summary, we'll talk about implications for soil and water management. So restoring the hydrology of these isolated wetlands for increased water storage and increased phosphorus storage, pretty important that one needs to consider the context of where one is working, such that one needs to know where the pea is being stored and in what components it is being stored, because because we found that there was very big differences between the sites, and in some situations no additional P was being stored, whereas other situations it was. And in terms of long-term storage, and one manages ecosystem predominantly for long-term storages, needs to take into account the soil organic matter and the accretion of soil organic matter, and that being important for phosphorus accretion and accumulation with time. And then finally, flooding of our uplands with low P water, and this may contribute to a phosphorus flux from soil to water, therefore impacting water quality. This may need to be mitigated for at the field scale, and it may be short term, it could be longer, we're not too sure. In practicality terms, maybe a mitigation might be with these drained wetlands, in terms of restoring them, one would put in a culvert, put in riser boards, and if you are losing P from soil to water, you need to put the riser boards in, therefore increasing the residence time within the wetland to allow for those biogeochemical processes to take place, therefore increasing the effectiveness of your wetland to act as a nutrient sink rather than a nutrient source. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Do you have any questions for Ed? Yes.
Can you look at the phosphorus speciation between the wetland types to see if certain wetland types have phosphorus species more susceptible to leaching into surrounding water bodies?
Yeah. This study only looked at these emergent marsh isolated wetlands, so it was emergent vegetation. A particular task in the larger project was a landscape study that sampled about 120 wetlands, and within that they sampled wooded wetlands, they sampled emergent marsh, they sampled areas that were simply dominated by water, and they looked at different P fractions, predominantly in the water column but not necessarily in the soils. I did some phosphorus fractionation work in these emergent marsh wetlands, and give or take, most of the P is in organic form, maybe 80%. Yeah, we did both actually. We test them at field moist conditions, oven dried and air dried, and you do get a variable response, absolutely. And actually we did some comparisons where we were determining water extractable phosphorus, and we did it with DDI, site water, and whether the soil was air dried, oven dried or field moist, and you got very, very different results. Incidentally, comparison between DDI water and the actual site water, it was actually the same, irrespective.
Any questions? All right, well, let's give a hand for all our speakers today.